From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the October 2025 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, the SIS at BP. Today, GCHQ is an independent British intelligence organisation. However, during World War II, GCNCS, as it was then called, continued to be subordinate to the British Secret Intelligence Service, known as SIS or MI6. The chief of SIS was also the director of GCNCS. In this episode, we explore the relationship between those two organisations, the part that SIS played in supporting GCNCS, and the ongoing presence of SIS at Bletchley Park itself. We are joined, as usual, by our research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, and by a special guest, historian and expert in the wartime SIS, Dr. Claire Hubbard-Hall.
David, let's start with you. How did GCNCS, the Government Code and Cipher School, come about? And can you tell us about its relationship with SIS?
GCNCS, as many of our regular listeners will know, is actually formed in 1919 by the amalgamation of the two service codebreaking organisations which have existed in World War I, which is MI1B in the Army and NID25, better known as Room 40, in the Navy, in the Admiralty. And what happened at the end of the war was, initially, there was a suggestion that nobody needed to do codebreaking anymore. This kind of happens in 1946 as well, but they get over themselves. But the plan was that it should be scaled down, obviously, because there was no war, and made into a civilian organisation. So GCNCS, the Government Code and Cipher School, is created. Initially, it's actually run by the Admiralty, and the man who's in charge of it was Hugh Sinclair, Admiral Sinclair. Bit of a character, Hugh Sinclair.
In what way?
Well, his nickname was Quex Sinclair, Quex being a reference to a Restoration drama, I believe it is, which has a character, the Gaylord Quex, the wickedest man in London.
So Sinclair was the wickedest man in London?
Let's just say he was a divorcee who liked to live life, and he was a very wealthy man. However, there's not much service traffic for GCNCS to read or decode or anything else. The armed forces of the world immediately after World War I, or certainly the ones that Britain are interested in, are not communicating very much. So their principal preoccupation is diplomatic telegrams. So other people's embassies communicating with their home countries. The advantage of that is that, for the British, is that most of those telegrams travel on British undersea cables. So the Official Secrets Act of 1920, in fact, includes a clause that says all of the British cable companies have to provide copies of other people's telegrams to GCNCS.
This is every single cable that's running on
those? Wow. Yes, they have to give drop copies to GCNCS. So that's basically what they're doing. In 1922, the organisation transfers from the Admiralty to the Foreign Office. Responsibility for the organisation, whose budget it should come out of.
Staff stay the same, it just...
The staff stay the same, but the thing is, because they're basically doing diplomatic correspondence, the Admiralty say, we're not interested in diplomatic code breaking. We shouldn't pay for it. The Foreign Office should pay for it. So they transfer into Foreign Office control. By curious coincidence, it's around the same time, Admiral Sinclair has ceased to be an admiral, except in name. He's retired from the Navy and become head of the Secret Intelligence Service. He's become head of SIS, MI6. So the organisation moves from the Admiralty to the Foreign Office, and Sinclair simultaneously moves from the Admiralty to the Foreign Office
or
to MI6.
Alongside yes. The organisation, right.
So he remains in charge, and he becomes what's known as C. This is because the previous head of MI6, since its foundation in 1909, was a man called Mansfield Cumming, died in 1923, and Sinclair took over. Interestingly, I mean, Claire will probably mention this as well, but Mansfield Cumming is the reason that all heads of SIS write in green ink, because he wrote in green ink and it became a thing.
Just the tradition continues.
Yes, and he used to sign letters C, which might well stand for Cumming, but people interpret it as also standing for chief of MI6, and they still do that. They still sign.
To this day.
To this day, they sign C in green ink because they like tradition, clearly. So that means that from 1922, GCNCS is a sort of sub-branch of SIS. And Alistair Denniston, who's been head of GCNCS since 1919, he's the head, he's not the director, because the director is nominally Hugh Sinclair. So GCNCS is for practical purposes, run by Alasdair Denniston, but for official purposes, run by the head of the Secret Intelligence Service, Sinclair.
And Alasdair Denniston's a Navy man. Is that a hangover from that military control of GCNCS?
Specifically that naval control, yes. The discussion when GCNCS was founded was whether they should have Alasdair Denniston, who'd been in Room 40, mm-hmm. or whether they should have Malcolm Hay, who was Army, who had run MI1B. And there are people within Whitehall who are campaigning for Hay and people who are campaigning for Denniston. But the Admiralty wins, basically, that argument.
Shortly before it's then transferred to and Foreign Office control.
Foreign Office, but right. Again, the head of SIS is a Navy man as well. So you do see a significant proportion of naval intelligence people within GCNCS. They have a kind of a bit of a grip on it. Interestingly, within SIS, GCNCS is a bit of a poor relation. Initially, they are sent to premises which are miles and miles away from SIS. But in 1925, they both moved to Broadway Buildings, which is their famous address opposite St. James's Park Tube Station in London. And GCNCS has a floor in that building. But the relationship between the two isn't as intimate as you might think, given that they, you know, one is part of the other and they work in the same building. SIS tends to largely ignore GCNCS.
I think of GCNCS, obviously the Bletchley Park era, huge numbers of people. I'm guessing this is a much smaller organisation.
It's about 50 people at this time. There's something like 26 pensionable officers. It means senior people because the junior people didn't get pensions. And about another 20, 25 sort of admin support staff. It's quite small. But interestingly, there's a note I came across doing some other research the other day. Wilfred Bodsworth, who is doing Italian code-breaking in GCNCS in the late 20s, early 1930s, he describes how SIS had managed to acquire an Italian codebook. And they said to the Italian section in GCNCS, "Oh, we've got this Italian codebook. Do you want to have a look?" And Bodsworth said, "Oh, yes, please." And the response from SIS was, "We can lend it to you, but we want it back tomorrow."
A codebook, though.
A codebook.
And GCNCS's role was codes and ciphers.
Yes.
And intercept.
Yes. And Bodsworth spent until the early hours of the morning copying out the codebook. And he says in his memoir, "I suppose SIS could have photographed it for me if I would have asked. But they certainly didn't offer, and it didn't occur to me to ask."
Doesn't sound like a hugely close relationship, exactly. Certainly between Bodsworth and
SIS. But yes, he basically spent till 3 o'clock in the morning copying this thing out longhand so he could give it back the next day.
I do hope they use the heck out of that codebook then in that case.
It did come in pretty handy, but that's another story. There's not much wireless at that point. It's mostly cable traffic. And as right. I say, it's mostly diplomatic traffic. And I should also add that all of their product goes to SIS, and then it's SIS's job to share it with the government departments or wherever else. So they are kind of the gatekeeper of GCNCS as well.
So it feels like they are working closely in that way, that all the material they're producing is ending up at SIS.
Oh yes, it's ending up in the right places.
Okay. But,
they're perhaps not given as much credit for the centrality of their activity within the wider SIS operation.
As we know, GCNCS didn't stay on that one floor in London. Can you tell us a bit more about what happened with GCNCS moving to Bletchley Park and how SIS was involved in that?
What's interesting is that Admiral Sinclair actually died in November 1939. So right at the beginning of World War II, he leaves the picture and is replaced by Stuart Mingies. But in 1937, 1938, he has been around to make a really game-changing contribution to the history of GCNCS in that he was the one that acquired Bletchley Park.
He himself personally visited and thought, that's the place for me.
We believe so. The problem that researchers like me have, and Claire will no doubt elaborate on this, is that when GCNCS is independent from SIS, or becomes more independent in the course of the war, its archives are kept separately and are publicly available. SIS archives are not publicly available. So what was in Sinclair's mind when he chose Bletchley Park, we don't know, because that paperwork has not been released.
There's lots of reasons given, though, out there. I mean, we've spoken about it on this podcast, I think, as well, about why was Bletchley Park chosen?
Yes, there's mythology around it, because there's the suggestion that the Varsity line from Oxford to Cambridge, which passes through Bletchley, was instrumental because dons could get home to their colleges for dinner. I'm not a big fan of that theory.
I was about to say, listeners can't see your face, but you look sceptical.
I am sceptical. I think more important is the fact that the trunk telephone cables to the north of England run past just over there, about three quarters of a mile away. And one of the things that Sinclair arranges in 1938 is for trenches to be dug across the field so that direct telephone cables could be connected. And basically, Bletchley Park is connected up electronically, telephonically to London and to the rest of the UK, which is really important. I can quite foresee that that would be one of his motivations, because there's no point picking a country house in the middle of nowhere that no one can actually communicate with.
Exactly. The ensuing name of the organisation as well, Government Communications Headquarters, gives the game away. Communications is key.
Communications is kind of key.
Yeah.
I should say the reason he acquires it is because of the perception that London will get very heavily bombed if there's a war. And so he looks for a war station for his codebreakers. And Bletchley Park has just been sold and is in the process of being redeveloped by a chap called Faulkner at the time. What would be really interesting would be to know how Sinclair met Faulkner, how he made the decision to buy the place, exactly how the sale happened. Basically, the only piece of paper we have is the land registry transfer of title document, which is in the public domain, which says Hubert Faulkner sells Bletchley Park to Admiral Sinclair for £6,000. It doesn't say who Hubert Faulkner is. For obvious reasons, it doesn't say who Admiral Sinclair is or whose money he's spending. We could talk at length about whose money he might or might not be spending. This is perhaps not the moment.
Different opinions. People
different opinions,
disagree,
yes.
Don't they? Yes.
So Sinclair is the key figure in GCNCS coming to Bletchley Park. And they actually arrive here in the flesh, if you like, in person, in September 1938, during the Munich crisis. They're here for about 6 weeks, and then they go back to London. He also is responsible for huts starting to be built in the summer of 1939.
Before war
breaks
declared,
out. Right. Again, some people believe that the huts are a response to everyone coming here. Mm. Actually, they already knew it was going to be cramped. So they start building huts before. They build a lot more after they've arrived.
Yeah,
but they
I think it's about four or something, isn't it, that are built?
So three or four that are built before the war breaks out. And then the war breaks out in September. The bulk of GCNCS come here, which will cause a problem I'll speak to you about in a moment. And then in November, Sinclair died. Mingus took over.
So we've talked about GCNCS being part of SIS, but we're now saying GCNCS was deployed to this war station at Bletchley Park, separated out from SIS, but that's not quite the picture. There wasn't this clean break and only GCNCS personnel came here to Bletchley.
We do have records in the so-called 1939 register, which is a kind of census of where everybody is at the beginning of the war. And that includes description of SIS personnel in Bletchley Park. There's a whole string of them who are described as chauffeurs, which is a SIS euphemism.
A smoothing term for describing what they're doing.
But it's pretty obvious that in September 1939, there are 184 codebreakers, GCNCS personnel, at Bletchley Park. But they're not the only ones there. A lot of other bits of SIS seem to have kind of inveigled their way in.
Inveigled?
And while downstairs is GCNCS, upstairs seems to be quite heavily SIS.
In the mansion.
In the mansion,
right.
Yes. And how these people have managed to get themselves on board, again, isn't clear because we don't have the SIS records. What it leads to is another of the great unsolved mysteries of Bletchley Park, if you like. For much of the war, the site is known as Station X. And there was some discussion about what Station X actually represents, you know, why it would be called that. Exactly how the name came about is not clear. But one thing is clear is that prior to the war, the SIS had its own clandestine wireless service. They needed to communicate with their representatives overseas. And so they had their own radio system for talking to these people and all the rest of it. That wireless station, which had been in Barnes in London pre-war, comes to Bletchley Park in 1939. And initially they set up in the top of the mansion. And there is another story, is that there was an aerial basically that went from the top of the mansion to the top of the big tree out the front. I think it's a sequoia. One account describes the top of the tree being blown off in a storm and there being a copper band around it where the other end of the aerial was attached. So they were in there. During 1939, it appears they move out of the mansion and into Hut 1. And Hut 1 was actually built originally as the SAS wireless station. And it's positioned on one of the old avenues of trees that the Lyons had established in the park here at Bletchley Park. And what they did was they built the hut between four trees, essentially cut the trees down to, well, not quite stumps, but sort of bare trunks, and then strung wireless aerials around the trees.
That's
so the reason Hut 1 is where it is because it originally sat in the centre of a rectangle created by these four trees.
Fantastic.
The result of that is that lots of other huts then get built in alignment with Hut 1, and it kind of determines the layout of the whole site. But in many accounts, that clandestine wireless station was known as Station X.
Right.
So the name may have become associated with Bletchley Park. Jumping ahead a bit, I'll talk about this in a bit, but that wireless station moves out to Warden Hall later on.
Right.
But we'll come back to that.
Yes, because Bletchley Park continues by various organisations and departments to be known as Station X for various reasons. Right.
That wasn't the only bit. One of the slightly more peculiar teams that are here is Section D of SIS.
Ooh, tell us more about Section D.
Section D is formed to carry out covert operations within SIS. More, I would say, kinetic covert operations, blowing stuff up, basically.
Kinetic. Wonderful.
So they're doing demolitions. Well, they're planning to do demolitions and things like that. And so Section D is briefly at Bletchley Park. Again, we don't know very much about it. Section D later became part of SOE. It was sort of farmed out from SIS. And Section D of SIS and a couple of other clandestine organisations, Electra House, who are doing the propaganda, all of these units become part of the Ministry of Economic Warfare and SOE, the clandestine organisation that's not SIS, during World War II.
Right. And leaves the Bletchley Park estate.
And they leave the Bletchley Park estate and they go away. There is evidence that they had an explosives magazine at Bletchley Park.
Where?
Well, I would love to know.
I know, I would too.
I've pressed every SOE expert I can find to see if there's any information about this. But again, SOE files from sort of 1941, 1942, once they get going, are separate and are released and can be read. But Section D files, when they were still part of SIS, are still buried in the SIS archive. So,
which is not open.
Which is not open. So I would love to know where the explosives magazine was, but possibly we will never know. Fairly clearly, people out in the grounds experimenting with blowing stuff up is not really compatible with code breaking. So
something must be written about it, surely, somewhere. You can't hide that.
There must be a memo from Frank Birch complaining about it.
Noise, at least.
Yeah,
exactly.
If he complains about music while you work, he would certainly have complained about things being blown up.
Or his office being 50 centimetres too small or something. Yes. Yeah.
The one section of SOS that we do know a lot about, and Claire is going to talk to us about this a bit more later on, is Hut 10, because the wireless station that SAS have, they also need to encrypt their traffic to communicate with their people overseas. So they need to have their own codes and ciphers. And they have a code-making outfit to support their wireless operations. The SAS code section is in the mansion in the early days. And from 1942 onwards, it's in Hut 10. And so you have a small group of mostly women SIS people sort of in one corner of Bletchley Park for the rest of the war. And we will hear a little bit more about them later on.
We've had some interesting information about how SIS and GCNCS cooperated on site at Bletchley Park or didn't work together on site at Bletchley Park. But you've mentioned a couple of places outside of Bletchley in that intelligence network. You mentioned Wadden Hall, for example. Are there any other places that are very much connected where the two organisations did work alongside each other?
Well, to address Wadden Hall first, as I said, SIS have this wireless operation of their own. And that operation is run by Section 8 of SIS, which is their communication section. That was headed from 1938 by Richard Gambier Parry.
The marvellous Richard Gambier Parry.
The marvellous Richard Gambier Parry.
Wonderful man.
Who had worked for the wireless company Philco before the war, and then he was sort of recruited by SIS. He's what you might call another colourful character.
Mm.
He looks like a bit of a Colonel Blimp figure. He was quite a substantial man.
But quite charismatic, though, wasn't he?
Yes, people seem to like him. And after the war, he runs casinos in Malta, which I think gives you a certain insight onto his character.
Excellent.
But yes, he was head of allowing SIS to communicate with the world. And so in February 1940, the outfit that is, we're provisionally referring to as Station X moved from Bletchley Park to Wadden Hall, which is only a few miles away from Bletchley Park itself. And they set up there an outfit which SIS refer to as Mainline, which is their main wireless station for overseas communication. You then get a point where GCNCS needs to send its product, the decrypts of the messages. Previously, they'd gone to SIS headquarters in London, and then Stuart McGee's has distributed them to government departments and to the military services and the rest of it. But we're now at a point where the armed services are deployed all over the world. And so Ultra, the Bletchley Park product, needs to be sent by wireless, effectively, to customers.
Rather than going via SIS in London.
Rather than going by cable through SIS.
Mm.
And so the obvious thing to do is to entrust that role to SIS's existing communication section.
That makes sense.
So Richard Gambier Parry at Wadden Hall, in addition to his doing his SIS communications, takes on the responsibility for doing GCNCS communications as well. And they set up these SCUs, special communications units, who are attached to all the foreign headquarters so that traffic can be sent. So what happens for most of the war is that information which has been derived here at Bletchley Park is re-enciphered, with our own codes sent to Wadden Hall, and then Wadden Hall can broadcast it by wireless to Montgomery in North Africa or Patton in Europe after D-Day or whatever. So in that sense, SIS remains responsible for GCNCS's communications. And actually the staff who work at Wadden, although a lot of them are in uniform, they are actually working for SIS. I knew very well one of our veterans, sadly passed away a couple of years ago, Jeffrey Pidgeon. He's a lovely chap. He always talks about how his pay book was stamped with not paid from War Office funds, which was the euphemism for his wages come from SIS's budget.
And it makes sense if they're at Wadden Hall as the war progresses and the amount of activity increases that they're able to therefore grow at Wadden Hall.
There's lots of huts, inevitably, like there are everywhere. There's the old country house itself, Wadden Hall, but in addition, there's the site known as Windy Ridge, where there's basically drafty huts full of wireless operators sending these messages out and receiving the replies in some cases. The second site, which SIS and GCNCS are involved with, is Hanslope Park. This is yet another country house north of Milton Keynes. This was requisitioned by the government in 1941, and there are various jobs that go on there. One of those is the Radio Security Service. These are an organisation that was set up to intercept clandestine radio traffic within the UK. Basically, German spies sending wireless messages back to Germany. There's not much of that after 1939, but they end up monitoring German clandestine radio traffic more generally, sort of worldwide almost. So the RSS is at Hanslope intercepting material that is then sent to Bletchley Park to two sections called ISK and ISOS, ISOS and ISK. So there's a link there. The other thing that's happening at Hanslope is the Diplomatic Wireless Service. And we've described how SIS has its own secret radio communications around the world. The Foreign Office needs to have, you know, normal communications between diplomats.
Yeah.
And that's done by the Diplomatic Wireless Service. Diplomatic Wireless Service, now HMGCC, is still at Hanslope.
Yes.
And they continue to provide communication services for the British government.
In the way that GCNCS in the war became GCHQ, HMGCC was the name that was derived during the war as well, isn't it? Now His Majesty's Government Communications Centre.
You also have an outfit called FCDO Services, as they're called now. They are a sort of research laboratory, and they invent things connected with government communications. And in fact, that's where in 1943, Alan Turing transfers from Bletchley Park, and he based at Hanslope in the latter part of the war.
Yes, working on Delilah.
Working on speech encryption, and he builds Delilah at Hanslope Park. And he sort of shares his time between Hanslope and Bletchley. But you can see that between Bletchley Park and Wadden and Hanslope and, of course, London, SIS and GCNCS and the RSS and DWS, I could go on, are all sort of entangled with one another, and they're doing jobs for each other, scratching each other's backs in different ways. And what this means is it becomes impossible to disentangle them all if you're going to tell the full story.
I love this, though, and I think this is quite an important message for this episode of the podcast for people to understand. Often people say Bletchley Park as if it's this lone, well, GCNCS as if it's this lone organisation, but that is impossible. It's part of a much bigger network of equally large and important and also other smaller organisations all contributing to the same goal at the end of the day, you know, victory and in the war. But perhaps we know less about them. Perhaps the information is out there and they've been less researched. Or perhaps they're just, you know, sort of quietly, even now, still getting along with things like HMGCC over at Hanslope Park. But I think it is an important thing to recognise that Bletchley Park is part of a much bigger picture. And I think it's interesting to hear how, with SIS and, as you say, all those other abbreviated organisations, that the activity is so important.
It is. There is also a mythology that Churchill said, you know, action this day, give Bletchley Park all they need and report to me it's been done. There is a perception that everything went smoothly and everybody got the resources they needed and everything just ticked along like a Swiss watch. What you have to remember is all these organisations are collaborating and cooperating, but also on certain days are arguing like cats in a sack. You know, there is a lot of admin and politics and office politics and the rest of it going on as well.
And the context is changing. The war is progressing. It's getting bigger and bigger. These places are growing and adapting and rubbing up against each other as well as rubbing along with each other.
Absolutely. And we're just talking about the Foreign Intelligence Service here. We're just talking about SAS. We haven't mentioned MI5 yet. That might be for another episode. That's a whole other episode.
Whole another episode, yeah. This is a perfect opportunity to move over to our guest on the podcast today, Dr. Claire Hubbard-Hall, She's an expert on the history of SIS and the author, most recently, of the excellent book, Her Secret Service, The Forgotten Women of British Intelligence. Claire, thank you so much for coming to see us at the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me on.
We want to know, first of all, a little bit about you and the area of history that you're particularly interested. Can you tell us how you became involved in researching SIS?
Okay, so it's a bit of a long-winded journey. So I originally started out as a specialist in German intelligence in the Third Reich, and I came across many SIS officers as on the opposite side to the German officers that I was working on. So that was the first instance. Then when I started lecturing, after I'd finished my PhD at university, I was then teaching about SIS in various undergraduate modules. But it wasn't until I started writing the book about women in British intelligence, where I looked at SIS as one of the organisations, that I really, really kind of became super interested in Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service.
Obviously, there's an enormous amount that we want to hear from you, and we could be here for hours. But can you tell us a little bit about SIS, particularly what it was doing at the start of the war and what it was doing just before?
So in the run-up to war, Admiral Sinclair is watching what's going on abroad, namely in Germany and Hitler, and is asking all of the MI6 stations abroad to keep an eye, to gather intelligence from agents with any news as to what Hitler might be going to do next. Admiral Sinclair seems to be very clued into Hitler's ambitions in terms of taking various European countries into the umbrella of the Third Reich and expanding his power and domination over Europe. You have these various MI6 stations that are utilising their agents, any contacts that they can have. For example, one agent's daughter in Europe is in contact quite daily with the Ribbentrop family and sort of petering through kind of any kind of intelligence information that they can gather, almost sort of like an early warning system if war is coming. And MI6, thanks to Admiral Sinclair really being on the ball with watching what's going on in Europe, starts to take action at home in terms of expanding MI6 and thinking about how is the organisation going to operate during war. Because since the end of the First World War, the organisation, like many of Britain's intelligence services, had contracted in size during peacetime. It didn't need the same number of individuals that it had during the First World War. So with a second war looming on the horizon, he's thinking about what a plan could be if war does break out. And one of those plans is activating various war stations. So Admiral Sinclair activates Bletchley Park as a war station in the autumn of 1938, thinking that war is going to break out with Germany. Neville Chamberlain has gone to Munich to negotiate with Hitler, but Sinclair is of the mind that he might not be successful. About 150 to 200 people arrive in Bletchley Park, government code and cipher school, and SIS individuals, all into the mansion, thinking that war is about to break out. And one individual in particular has been tasked by Admiral Sinclair, Captain William Ridley, to organise the move and to make sure Bletchley Park is all set up and ready for all the staff that are arriving. He does the job quite well. But they arrive, but there aren't filing cabinets there, there aren't bookshelves, there aren't the actual office stationery and furniture that's needed. So there are lessons learnt from this exercise that it didn't perhaps go as well as what it should have done. And of course, Neville Chamberlain comes back, announces famously, "Peace in our time," waves the paper, and war doesn't happen. So of course, everybody then returns back to London. And in the run-up to the outbreak of war in September 1939, Sinclair again is gathering information from his agents, from officers within the embassies posted overseas, and really kind of trying to gather information on what Hitler is planning. Sinclair recognises that Hitler is a fanatic, that he's ambitious, that he is also makes kind of lightning choices, decisions. So there is no kind of predicting really what he's going to do. But Admiral Sinclair does have the foresight to recognise that countries like Poland, for instance, are going to be, in Sinclair's words, for it in the near future. And how right he was, because, of course, Hitler invades Poland, instigating the outbreak of the Second World War at the beginning of September 1939. In that run-up from the summer of 1939 to September, we have the first wave of SIS and government code and cipher school staff arriving at Bletchley Park, ready and waiting to be activated.
It's so interesting because we, and listeners of the podcast, we obviously coming from a signals intelligence perspective, but as we're looking here at SIS as well, it's interesting to start thinking of Sinclair as somebody with a much broader range of sources. He has agents, he has these other departments within SIS helping to shape that picture of what he's doing. From the material you've seen, do you get a sense of that variety of sources feeding into his decision making?
Absolutely. And he's so forward thinking that he's recognising that, as in producers and consumers of intelligence, that SIS has to be wired into the plug board with other intelligence services. So whether that's the military or other newbies like SOE that will come about in 1940 once the war gets going. At that point, Stuart Mingus has become C in 1940. But Admiral Sinclair is clever because he actually institutes liaison officers within these organisations, representatives, so that all this information can be feeding forwards and backwards to SIS. And there is this symbiosis, really, of human intelligence and communications, which has been right there since Government Code and Cipher School came about, that they do go hand in hand. And I think looking at the broader picture of intelligence that you've spoken about before in previous podcasts, where they don't operate alone, everything fits into the bigger picture. But I would say from a large part during the Second World War, comms, communications is key to the secret war.
Particularly at the start of the war as well, when the organisations were much smaller, I guess it also, though, came down to the decisions and the activities of individuals' personalities. Are there people that you've come across in your research, maybe at the start of the war, that particularly are of interest to you in what they were like or what they did?
Absolutely. There are several individuals, but as you can probably imagine, that when you're looking at MI6 individuals, it's quite difficult because a considerable amount of mystery still surrounds them and what they actually did during the war. But one of the first individuals that's always fascinated me is Captain William Ridley, because he plays such a key role in the activation of the war station in 38 and then carrying on from 1939 onwards for a couple of years, overseeing the administration of Bletchley Park and sharing that role with a government code and cipher school colleague, Alan Bradshaw. So he's quite central in terms of maintaining that SIS control, even though it's sort of a dual running of Bletchley Park. And this becomes a bone of contention, I think, as things start to progress in the war, this sort of coexistence of SIS and government code and cipher school on the same site. But Captain William Ridley is fairly enigmatic as an individual, but I did manage to tease out some interesting facts about him. So along with a number of other interesting MI6 officers who were at Bletchley Park at the start of the Second World War, they have been working for SIS since the late 20s, early 30s. Again, it's unknown as to how actually they became recruited, but they suddenly join MI6 at that point. Captain Ridley, he was born in Canada, in British Columbia. He grew up on a cattle ranch with what his family owned. And then, like most of the sons in the family, he was shipped off to a boarding school in Reading here in the UK. And from there, he went to Dartmouth. And then during the First World War, he was seconded to the Royal Australian Navy, won lots of medals. And then at some point in the 20s, joins SIS under Admiral Sinclair, who again has this naval background. So you can clearly see that we'll never be able to prove it, but those social links, those military links, those naval links with these individuals are there in terms of how these individuals become recruited. When Captain Ridley is at Bletchley Park, his wife, Vera, works as his secretary, which again throws light on the informal vetting procedure of how SIS recruited individuals to work for it at that time. It was through that extension of trust, so family members tended to crop up quite a lot. This is well before professional vetting came in at the end of the Second World War. And they lived in this beautiful thatched cottage in Bletchley, so again, very close to site, so they could be here working all hours if needed. And he really was, again, key in terms of the administration, which he did eventually hand over in 1942 when SIS left Bletchley Park. He handed control over to Government Code and Cipher School, but SIS did maintain control of security of the site. They kept that within its remit. So you have these sort of first couple of years with an SIS presence, because there are also a number of other individuals at the start who are billeted out at Wadden Hall. And these tended to be long-term MI6 careerists, whether they're officers or women who are working in some capacity. And one of those individuals is a lady called Kathleen Pettigrew, who features in my book as a central character. Her story is woven from beginning to end, and she was the inspiration for Ian Fleming's Miss Moneypenny.
Yes.
But she was way more than a secretary. And of course, a lot of the women who were at Bletchley Park working for SIS have that label secretary. It's a perfect cover. But of course, they're doing a huge range of things. They're not just sat at the typewriter typing reports. They're translating, they're coding, they're decoding. They are acting as couriers. They are doing a whole range of jobs. So we have Kathleen Pettigrew, and we know that at the very start of the Second World War, she was on the first floor of the mansion, along with a number of other SIS staff, and she was influential in setting up the CODIS section.
What did they do?
MI6 had its own communications set up, which was basically encoding and decoding messages to its agents abroad, and also its officers who are based in embassies around the world, working under the cover of passport control, which became a euphemism for saying, yes, I'm MI6. And Kathleen Pettigrew sets up on the first floor the coding section, so overseeing the comms with agents and officers abroad. And there are a number of other MI6 careerists, women, who are working under her. One of them is called Olive Montgomery. I'll talk a bit more about her in a short while, because she spent most of her time at Bletchley Park. She went on into Hut 10, which is where the coding section moved in 1942 from the mansion to Hut 10, which had previously had the air intelligence section located within it. So we had Olive Montgomery, who had worked for the first SIS chief, Mansfield Cumming, during the First World War. She'd been a governess before she joined SIS. And a lot of these women, like Kathleen, they hadn't gone to university. They had either come from sort of middle class, upper class backgrounds, where they might have had a private education, where languages played a key role. But the thing about Kathleen, which makes her story particularly interesting, is that she actually came from very humble beginnings, a working class background in London, and managed to make her way in the secret world and forged herself a career and became this financial independent earning woman, which is quite an achievement to do that through the interwar periods.
Well, as you were saying, when you were talking about Captain Ridley and his wife and this sort of connections being so important, particularly in the secret world, it is really surprising to hear of somebody who is not connected to that world, and that their background is perhaps more humble, and that she brought herself into that world and became influential in it.
Absolutely. And MI6, when you look at the women who, in particular, who worked for the organisation, who did make their careers in the shadows, if you want to call it, they were these self-made women who came from very sort of professionally technical training backgrounds, went to secretarial training college, stenography, etc. But they also had the languages as well. So they had these key skills, which the intelligence services were looking for at the time. And they would be what we would call now, in a modern sense, sort of information managers,
yes,
if you want to look at it in that way. And a lot of the processes in terms of information gathering, storage, etc., are the results of the processes that these women put in place. So the mansion on the first floor, which nobody can ever get up there, it's sort of seen as this mysterious place. You know, who went up the wonderful staircase at the back of the mansion? But there were a number of offices. You had what was known by some of the women as the coding room, which was a massive room located at the back of the mansion above the ballroom. And because the ballroom housed the teleprinter room on the ground floor, they ran the copper wires up into the big room above that, which was known as the coding room. And then they had the teleprinters in there and tables initially for coding work. Those teleprinters were connected to 54 Broadway, which was the SIS headquarters, the Central Telegraph Office in London, and then also very soon afterwards, Wadden Hall, which was Section 8 of SIS, which dealt with communications. So you had this wonderful loud clicking noise continuously from these teleprinters located in this room, which were constantly going. And you can hear this noise outside in the corridors. And the women talk about this in the oral histories. And one of the women, Eileen McCarthy, was in charge of working on these teleprinters and receiving the incoming messages and plugging them back in to go to headquarters, back to London or Wadden Hall, etc. And she visited Bletchley Park in 2001. And her visit in the mansion was recorded because they actually took her up onto the first floor and traced through the corridors the steps that she had taken when she'd walked during the war, which is quite incredible.
That is, isn't it?
And this is all on this wonderful recording. And she's got this beautifully soft Cockney accent. So you've got this little old lady walking around on the first floor, retracing those steps. And she talks about how she was constantly running backwards and forwards from the teleprinter room to Station X, the SIS radio station in the attic, and talks about talking with the men that worked in there and just general life at Bletchley Park in the mansion. And she was there from the summer of 1939 as a 19-year-old. And by extension, her younger sister, who was 17, Dorothy, she worked as a confidential messenger within the mansion. And in her written oral history, she talks about delivering these secret messages and saying how on the doors, there were only small plaques with numbers on for security reasons, so there were no names. And she talks about taking messages to Richard Gambier Parry, who was her boss, the head of Section 8, and describing him as a very sort of kind man and also with a really good sense of humour, and recalls how affectionately they would refer to him, the women, as Pops. That was his name. There's this wonderful photograph within the archive of Richard Gambier Parry, and he's stood rather comically with a feather duster in one hand and putting the feather duster below his chin to make out it was a beard, which really gives you a sense of his personality. So you get this kind of really interesting mix of individuals within SIS, that there is no sort of set type in a way, because Dorothy and Eileen, these two very young sisters, are from a working class background in London, and they join SIS because they have an aunt who cleans the big houses in London that are owned by MI6 officers, which really is quite astounding, isn't it?
That is.
And then they're joining these sort of middle-aged SIS careerist women like Kathleen Pettigrew, Olive Montgomery. And then we also have another group of individuals that come on later in the war. So it's really sort of this eclectic mix of individuals, which paints quite an interesting picture as a workforce.
Do we have a sense of how many SIS people were here? Was it in the tens, the hundreds, say at this sort of earlier stage of the war?
I mean, I've tried to look from various sources using things like the 1939 register, which was taken in September 1939, because they're there as MI6, which was used as a cover, which of course we know what that means now.
Terrible cover these days, isn't it? Yeah.
So I've tried to look at those kinds of sources and just generally try and keep a database of whenever I come across anybody working for SIS at Bletchley in memoirs, oral testimonies. And I have got my spreadsheet to about in the 90s.
Right. I think that's really key to mention at this point, just like the GCNCS, there's no list that we can easily look at of everybody that was here.
Well, the bulk of that is using the sources here at Bletchley Park with the oral histories and the material within the archive. Mm-hmm. So I've managed to build up a picture with that, with then these other external sources. But that's at the very beginning, mm-hmm. 1939, because of course, by the time we get to early 1940, a lot of those individuals return back to London and the work then continues back in London at HQ at 54 Broadway. But SIS still has this presence on site. You've got Captain Ridley overseeing the administration, and then you've still got SIS codes, the women who are working in the code section. And you can imagine the mansion isn't that big. So to have all these people, they really must have been on top of each other. And I can only imagine that that caused friction between SIS and Government Code and Cipher School, trying to coexist in this house that isn't big enough to contain them. But from 1942, when SIS largely removes itself entirely from Bletchley Park and Ridley hands over administration, you're just left with SIS codes. They then make the move from the mansion to Hut 10, and that's where they stay for the remainder of the war. And the number of women, largely women, who are working under a male head, Leslie Rowley Hill, there's about 100. So it's a sizable amount.
Yeah.
And they're obviously working on a three-shift rota like the other individuals are working at Bletchley Park. So it's quite a sizable number that's still left, but they are all now contained within Hut 10 and working very much in isolation to the rest of Bletchley Park. But the other interesting aspect that I did find when I was looking at what was going on in Bletchley Park, and David has already referred to Section D, the people who made the big bangs of SIS, I came across, which I don't think has ever been sort of utilised in any way, is a post-war recollection of a woman called Lois Hamilton, who worked in Section D, and it was deposited in the Imperial War Museum. And this fantastic account of her time in the war working in Section D and being at Bletchley Park before the war broke out, and then for the first few months, because Section D left in November 1939, and her office was in a sort of, I would say, a broom cupboard that had been converted into an office for her within the mansion. And she talks about one particular incident, which is quite hair-raising when you sort of reflect on it. But before she left London, she had met somebody from the Woolwich Arsenal who had given her an attaché case to carry to Bletchley Park. And when she arrived, she was met by one of Section D's scientific officers, who promptly walked her with the attaché case to the lake.
Right.
Then stepped back from the attaché case. The scientific officer stepped forward, opened the case, and it instantly burst into flames.
Wow.
She had been carrying an experimental incendiary device within her attaché case, which to me, from reading the recollection, seemed like it was incredibly unstable.
Experimental being the key word.
Yes, here. Experimental. Can you imagine if that had set alight on her train journey? Goodness me.
Wow.
So in typical British fashion, they stood not saying anything, watching the case burn at the lake, and then returned to the mansion for lunch, and nothing more was said of the incident.
Oh, to know what happened with those experimental attaché cases as well.
So that gives you this kind of, again, this incredible picture of those very early months at Bletchley Park, where you've got code breakers wanting peace and quiet to do incredible work. You've got SIS then really being a pain in the bottom because they're blowing things up, setting things alight, and there's too many of them in the mansion. So you can imagine that...
as well as running cables and transmitting messages.
Yeah, it must have been absolutely chaotic.
Yeah.
And it really does sort of give you a sense that Bletchley Park was this very, very active site. And yes, things had to change.
Going back to Hut 10 and a bit more detail about it, you said there's around 100 people at its largest. Do you have any more detail about the kinds of people that were there? Were they all women, for example, in Hut 10?
They were all women, but they were headed by one chap, a retired General Leslie Rowley Hill, who was in his 50s, and he was a brilliant linguist, which, of course, you needed to be working in Hut 10, communicating with foreign agents out in the field. And the women who worked in Hut 10, again, had to be linguists. So they had to know French, Dutch, Norwegian, etc. So they were highly skilled. But Leslie Rowley Hill had been tasked for finding women to work in Hut 10 on SIS codes. And he basically recruited the daughters and nieces of his friends, basically, people within his social circles. He's quite an interesting chap. Again, like most of the MI6 officers, he has that military background. So he was at the Royal Military Academy in Woolwich. In the interwar, he was a military attaché at the Tokyo Embassy, and then at some point joins SIS and finds himself at Bletchley Park for the whole of the Second World War, overseeing this mixture of young and middle-aged women, which you can imagine young sort of debutante socialites or those very young working class women working alongside very serious middle-aged MI6 career women must have been quite an interesting challenge. Working under Leslie Rowley Hill, he had a deputy, and that role was performed by a woman. The first deputy was a socialite, divorcee, Lady Cynthia Tothill, who had been the face of Pond Beauty Products, and she was very glamorous. She had also been in the gossip columns for various relationships and, of course, her divorces. She was a really interesting character to head up the first deputy post, but she left in June 1943. And then that post was filled by a completely different type of woman, Olive Montgomery, who I've mentioned before, the MI6 long-term careerist who'd worked under the first SIS chief, Mansfield Cumming. She was a spinster. She was in her late 40s, early 50s. She was a very thin, matronly type looking woman who had this peculiar habit of wearing very long paper sleeves, cuffs. Each day they would be changed. So quite odd in terms of a practice. And she took up the post when Lady Cynthia Tothill left and was deputy for the remainder of the war. What's interesting about the women who were working within Hut 10, they would sit at two very long tables, and the women who were working on the actual coding work would actually be in direct communication with the agents out in the field. So unlike Government Code and Cipher School staff who worked in isolation doing a very specific job which they saw as being very mundane, having no idea of how it fitted into the bigger picture of the war, the SIS women did. So they knew when their agents stopped communicating what that reason would be, or if the SIS agents out in the field had said the network's been broken up, the Gestapo have got us, or feeding back what had happened to other agents in terms of interrogation and death. And a number of the women in their post-war interviews that are held here at Bletchley Park, they talk about the trauma that they lived with and the nightmares that they suffered after the war because of the work that they had conducted here. So that's very different to the rest of the staff largely working at Bletchley Park. But they worked in isolation. They were not sort of connected in any way to what was going on with the Government Code and Cipher School comms work.
Did that cause friction, or were they so isolated that they didn't really end up sort of touching the work that GCNCS was doing?
I think they were so isolated there was no friction, but they were known as the babes by the sort of professor type code breakers, etc., who saw them sort of as these model type, you know, sort of brilliantly sort of perfect hair and clothes and probably smelling very nice as well as they're walking in and out of Hut 10. And equally for these women, they're probably looking at these professor type code breakers and looking at them like they're sort of aliens on another planet, because they do look so different to the social circles that they're used to mixing in.
Well, it's so interesting thinking of them in Hut 10, just knowing the site later on in the war as well, the number of uniformed personnel that would be on site.
Yeah.
Hut 11A being used for bombs, Hut 11B and 11 as well, and then being right so cheek by jowl in that corner of the site with the uniformed services and people from different backgrounds doing very, very different jobs. It's so fascinating to think that they are still there shuttling, you know, day in, day out to their role.
Yeah.
And it's so different to the work that's going on just next door.
Absolutely. Which I guess is sort of that microcosm on site of the war, isn't it? Of all these different aspects that are actually happening. And SIS Codes Hut 10 is in operation till the end of the war. And within the archive collection here, there is a lovely Christmas card that the Hut 10 staff have sent to their boss, Leslie Rowley Hill. All the little initials, there's a few annotations on there as well. So again, you can sense to work out that this was a close team, that they obviously did all pull together, even though they are this mishmash from different social backgrounds, etc., that there was a commonality and that they were there to do a job, a very important job, maintaining comms, communications with agents out in the field.
I'm constantly impressed about the amount of information you're able to uncover, knowing that SIS archives are not publicly accessible, that there is a lot that is still hidden away. We don't even know what's hidden away. And so when you're piecing these stories together, the way you talk about the personal experiences, it's kind of our way into understanding what was going on in these places.
Absolutely. It's the starting point, and you start to pull enough threads in the hope that one will just keep going and going and going. Mm. And then you start to make these wonderful connections and building the picture out. But again, there's always going to be those frustrating gaps within the story that you can try and plug, but really we need to be let into those archives.
Yes. Yeah, I think we should start the rallying cry now, the call of all intelligence historians wanting access to more material. Obviously, there are so many more things that we could talk about. There's so many more questions I have for you. I strongly recommend for people to read your book, Her Secret Service. I'm currently about 2/3 of the way through of it myself and really enjoying it. While we have you here, though, I wanted to find out, do you have any perspective, I suppose, on the relationships between MI6 and GCHQ today? Have you been able to pick up from the people you've spoken to or the research that you've done? Does any of that continue into the present day about how the two work together or didn't work together?
That's a very good question. And I think the only response that I can give is how excited I am of the working partnership of the two first female heads of MI6, Blaise Metrovelli, who's recently taken office of SIS, and Anne Keith Butler, the first female director of GCHQ, who succeeded in 2023. For the first time, we have two women at the helm of human intelligence and comms. Both women have very sort of, there's connections with their backgrounds. So they both were at the director level within MI5 for periods within their career. But they also have this technology and innovation background, and something that I think in the 21st century, looking at the working relationship between human intelligence and comms, just as we had in the Second World War, of how important it is to be able to read the messages of target organisations and individuals and to back that up with human intelligence or reinforce human intelligence operations that they are going to be successful in a particular way, I think is incredibly important. And for these two women to be the head of these two organisations at this particular moment in time with the cyber aspect, I think the country couldn't be in better hands.
Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Claire.
Thank you.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.